Today is December the 11th, 1972. Interview with General Clark. Well, in that case, I'll just skim through some of the contents of these papers. I should mention what they are first. These are taken from the files of the Department of External Affairs, and they relate primarily, a great many of them in any case, to military matters of one sort or another. They're not in any particular sequence, since I haven't changed them, you know, I haven't gone through it since Ottawa. This first one, for example, deals with a meeting of the Commonwealth Prime Ministers in June-July 1957. And he mentioned that he saw no change in the Russian attitude. He wanted to maintain an effective system of defense. He was in favor of close cooperation with the Commonwealth, willing to continue the UNEF between Israel and Egypt. And with respect to the military, more particularly, he was all in favor of disarmament, like motherhood. He favored fewer atom bomb tests, reduction of armaments. He was also willing, and I've noticed this elsewhere, to exchange the inspection of Canadian territory by aerial means if the USSR would. Just to stop on that one for a moment, because this does come up elsewhere, this idea that seems to have emerged about, well, where I come across it is 1957, 1958, the idea that Canada could act as the great neutral nation between Russia and the States. Do you remember anything of that at all?
No.
Maybe it didn't come up into anyone.
Must have been the political realm, at least I...
It could easily be.
Regarding the offer, presumably you were speaking of Mr. Diefenbaker.
Yeah.
Well, I would think that there would be no trouble making an offer of that sort, because the chance of it being accepted was so remote.
Yeah.
So close to nil, it's easy to make, I think.
With respect to, more particularly, with respect to defense, directly on defense, and I'm not sure at this point whether it's Diefenbaker or Perk speaking, but he is speaking with the other, you know, prime ministers. He said that Canadian defense is based primarily on a close association with NATO, maintaining contribution to the warning system and other defenses of the nuclear retaliatory forces of North America to protect the USA was, to his mind, to protect NATO. This, again, I remember Perks mentioning that somehow or other the people in NATO never really appreciated the fact that the fact of Canada's contribution to NORAD didn't seem to cut any ice with them. I remember Perks, for example, saying on his first or second trip over to one of the NATO ministerial meetings that he went over there hoping to get a reduction, basing this on the amount of effort we were spending protecting the North American continent. Now, would you like to comment on that?
Well,
is it a fair argument? This is what I'm saying in brief.
The impression I gained at the various NATO discussions was that our NATO members, and particularly France, this is before Germany became a member of NATO, did not like it. There was an exclusive arrangement between the United States and Canada, in which France was one, to the extent Britain felt this way, I'm not sure, had no say.
Mm-hmm.
America had obviously a predominant voice in NATO,
mm-hmm.
and since, in fact, going far enough back, that would, France always considered Algeria part of metropolitan France, so that in a sense, the NATO partners had a say in virtually all the forces of the NATO countries because they were deployed mostly, if not exclusively, in the NATO area or the area of those countries that made up NATO in Europe. And they would have liked, indeed, I think, to have had a say in North American defense. For example, they may have suggested that we should have less defense here and more over in the continent. And I think it was for this reason that the United States did not wish to have the NORAD arrangement as part of NATO. Well, that's a logical thing, I think, from an American point of view.
Were there any other regional pacts over there? This is something I could find out.
Yes. The Brussels Treaty, the Western Union Defense Organization under the Brussels Treaty, is still in existence today, as far as I know, and that continued. But shortly after the formation of all the military committees, economic and other committees of NATO, the Brussels Treaty, or at least the organization set up under the Brussels Treaty, became more or less redundant.
Yeah.
But that still was an internal arrangement. And the you can check this out, but as far as I know, the Brussels Treaty may continue to this day.
I never thought of it. I thought it was merged right in.
No, it continued as all the members, all the Brussels Treaty powers, which are France, Benelux, England, they became all members of NATO. But I think if we check our books, they did not continue it. Now, whether they held the odd political meetings or not, I don't know. I attended all the Western Union Defense Organization meetings. I know that some of them I continued, the Security Committee. I continued to attend it after NATO was formed and until such time as we had a corresponding committee set up in NATO.
Mm. Yeah, that'd be worthwhile checking out.
I cannot remember dates, but I do remember still going to the Security Committee.
There's one here, and it's just a small question, relating to the UN. Go ahead.
These are obvious ones. Britain had other commitments at various times along the way in CETO.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Which were not.
They were not regional
in that sense, but they did have other treaties, and because of these other treaties and commitments to them, they had forces in the Middle East, they had forces in the Far East, and so those had to be taken into account.
Yeah.
France had some forces, well, as we say, Algeria and metropolitan France, but it had other forces in colonial territories at that time.
Yeah.
The Dutch had lost, so far as I recall, it had lost all its territorial colonial possessions. So there was Britain, would be one, France's forces. They were out of Indochina at that time. They were out of Syria. They were out of the Middle East pretty well. But they did have forces, I imagine, of small sizes of garrisons in various parts of the French Empire in Africa.
Yeah. When Canada accepted something like the UNEF, and I noticed here that the estimated yearly cost was $16.5 million, did that come out of the defense budget, or would the defense be given an extra $15 or $16.5 million to take care of that if we took on additional peacekeeping duties?
As far as I recall, the answer is no. Mm. Presumably these various additional activities were supposed to be taken into account or regard would be had to your expenditures. But I'll show how far it went. We had, in the Army at that time, we had two separate votes, apart from the Army vote, I think it was 200 Mm-hmm. We had 207, 208, which was the Northwest Highway System and the Northwest Territory and Yukon radio stations. And they were separate folks. But when they bought down our size of the pie, then I would say, then we have the NWT, folks 207, 208. The argument was, they're all in there. So I recall, certainly as QMG and as CGS, getting no extra money whatsoever, because primarily the pay of these people, they were paid anyway.
Yeah.
We didn't raise forces over and above the forces we should have had for NATO and for the reinforcements. Yeah. And this became an argument all the time, whether we'd have or not have them. But the fact remains that when we sent officers, I remember once we had about 50 officers, major and lieutenant colonel, in Palestine. We didn't group all officers. You can't have that many with lieutenant colonels and some youngsters in behind. We just thinned out our units. And when we sent them overseas, that would be a unit which had done its tour in NATO. And others was one of the tours they could do. So I think there was, in my view, there was nothing extra to cut.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they would have been paid anyway. And since there was very little expenditure of ammunition, and since there was, in my view, no special equipment, we had scout cars and jeeps and things of this sort, we had them in any event.
Yeah.
So I would have thought not.
Yeah, it's they would be on the books, but they, just because they happened to be located in Egypt or where have you, that I can see where the Treasury boys would say, well, they are yours, they belong to you, and presumably if the coal were hot, you would just pull them out of Egypt and slap them into Europe or wherever they...
That's right. Now, the Air Force did, as I understand it, remember, get a few extra planes because of this, because the resupply of the forces is carried up. Partially, at least, by aircraft, and then we did supply some aircraft, and I think the first thing is up, starts off in the Army budget, was the Beaver, the Otter, the
Caribou.
Well, no, not the Caribou. The Beaver, the Mustang. Caribou, that's it.
Yeah.
Now, they bought four, I think it was.
Yeah.
They were short takeoff and landing. We tried to get them to buy them for the Army in Canada. The answer was no, but they bought them for the forces over there, so there we are. So they got a little extra, but I feel the Army did not, nor did our Navy.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the problems that you would have, and this seems to be a continuing problem, is this one that's coming up. This relates to the June 1957 conference, and I have here, in 1957, there was greater disposition on the part of NATO members to reduce military contributions. This was owing to the shifts in Russian policy, plus the British desire to reduce British forces in Europe. What they were doing at this time was suggesting fewer troops but more firepower. Now, earlier in 1952, the NATO commanders had suggested that the NATO lineup should be between 65 to 90 divisions, plus the nuclear deterrent. The former, the 65 plus divisions, was needed to prevent the overrunning of Europe. In other words, it was going to be the shield. Now, the estimate ultimately goes down to 30 divisions, but still with the British wanting 2,700 men reduction and indeed less aircraft. This in turn meant that the NATO members were very much against the British withdrawal. The British were pleading foreign exchange problems, their willingness to make certain adjustments and all that sort of thing. The Canadian concern was that, first of all, the British reduction would give too great German preponderance of troops in the NATO lineup. Now, do you remember anything of that?
No. I was in Central Command at that time, away from headquarters. And surprising you're not far from all of it. Your job then is completely with the truth. You're not in on policy matters.
Mm-hmm.
Nor have I ever heard it discussed. I wonder if it was really serious.
Well, there was an awful lot of arguments over, I remember that.
You like it.
Yeah. And the next deals with the American overflight in Canada. By 1957, there was in existence an agreement with the United States to allow the United States Air Force overflights to Canadian territory and make interceptions with aircraft carrying air-to-air nuclear weapons. By 1957, an extension was needed. Naturally, this wouldn't be done except in the cases of the highest alert. It would be wartime or close to it, but they were anxious to make agreements beforehand. Now, under the Aeronautics Act, evidently, the Minister of National Defense had to approve any overflight by the U.S. or indeed the British. Any of the latter carrying A weapons would have to be approved by the Minister of National Defense, the Secretary of State for External Affairs, and the Prime Minister. Now, evidently, during the Liberal period, permission for overflights was fairly easy to come by. But it seems to be very much on the old boy basis, from all I can gather.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, it's even, you know, indicated in the files. Now, again, this is on the Air Force, and I don't know if you'd like to make any comment on that or not.
I can only comment from 58 on, when I was back in Ottawa, and I believe that's largely the way it was, but I didn't understand the... Obviously, I haven't read the terms. It seems to sound very strange to me. Approved by the Minister of National Defense, the Under Secretary for External Affairs, and the Prime Minister, surely would be and or, because if the Prime Minister approved it, surely the other people are only recommenders then.
Probably.
Or else, it doesn't mean that either that he could delegate authority to either or both of the others.
Well, much would depend, evidently, if they were carrying atomic weapons. Now, I would assume that if they're just making, you know, training overflights, the Minister of National Defense, that his okay would be sufficient. But I rather suspect that even if they were carrying atom weapons, that surely the Secretary of State for External Affairs and the Prime Minister and the Minister of National Defense, that presumably the PM wouldn't give the okay to the Minister, I would imagine.
I would have thought that may be the way it was. I would have thought that either he had delegated it to the Minister, who would keep informed of what he was doing, or else the Minister had to recommend it, and then the Prime Minister approved, because that virtually suggests an inner cabinet of three people, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Although, on the other hand, I can see where the three people would be involved. Now, I remember later, of course, as time goes on, in the late 50s and early 60s, especially in the early 60s, when Diefenbaker becomes extremely touchy about atomic warheads in any craft, anywhere. Do you remember that bit?
Yes, I do. That's when the Honest John came up, and they, the Honest John, the Bomark was under consideration, and the equipping of our, I think it was the F-101s, but they were in continental Europe, planes overseas. Yes, it became a very touchy subject, indeed.
Yeah. Now the next, I don't know. I may, and I rather suspect I do have further notes on that at a later period. And the next one again is relates to the stockpiling of nuclear weapons. On the 16th of July, 1957, the Secretary of State Dulles, at a press conference in Washington, said the United States was studying ways whereby, perhaps through a NATO stockpile of weapons, there can be assurance to our allies that if war comes, they will not have to be succumb to the United States. And in this, the United States was backing him up. Now, the Canadian position was that, first of all, presumably they would be available to Canada. Presumably they would be located in Europe at the outset of the agreement. And I have a note saying that present agreements between Canada and NATO countries, where the Air Force had bases, assumed RCAF using conventional weapons, but a wider agreement was possible. What are the stockpiles in Canada? There's no reference in the Canadian-American agreements to date regarding A weapons on Canadian-based on Canadian-positioned U.S. bases. In fact, there was no distinction made between conventional weapons and any other weapons when these bases, of course, were first leased. And this was a good question. Presumably, before the United States had any stockpiles in Canada for United States aircraft, treaties would have to be negotiated. But what are the control of the atomic stockpile? And then there's always this spread of atomic bomb, you know, being, proliferation of a bomb. There was a fear of an accident at any of the bases. And then you come into the problem whereby curbs might negate a greater sense of NATO unity, and the best bet might be to have SACUR in charge. You see, it's controlled by the NATO Military Council, in other words, by civilian control, and this was the Canadian position. Here again, any comment on that? Now this again is July 1957.
Well, I think that may have been the position at that time. I was never in any discussions, but later on it was certainly changed, first of all in regard to Europe. Atomic warheads were placed within where they were needed. There were, we, for example, had to pay the money to build the storage areas for the warheads and provide quarters and or barracks for the American soldiers who were guarding them. In other words, they weren't handed over to us.
No.
They were earmarked for us, placed under American guard, and we did not pay, I feel quite sure, I remember it, for the warheads, but we did pay the cost of storage and the person who looked after them. And
That would be just the Americans, so that wouldn't be Canadian Americans at this time, in
57. Not in 57, no, that came later on, that came in the 58-61 period.
Yeah.
No, and the Army didn't have the Army had no, his first atomic weapon was the Honest John, that didn't come until 59, I guess it was. Bullmark was not installed at that time, so there's no question we didn't have any Bullmark missiles up in North Bay or Lanarkasa.
Yeah.
And I suppose the only places that, the main place that would be of interest was would be Goose Bay, where there were American forces. And
it surprised me, incidentally, the size of American forces in Canada in 1957, which was something like approximately 15,000 U.S. servicemen in Canada, of which some three-quarters, mind you, were in Newfoundland.
Yes, in Newfoundland, and then, of course, at that time, they were building up the Deer Line, Mid-Canada Line, and there were a lot of, if you recall, or the majority of the radar stations in the Deer Line were American, and then later, more and more American civilian companies took over the contract for maintenance and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Then at a later time still, when there was an examination of contributions, the RCAF took over some of the radar stations on the Deux Line and other ones in BC which had been built and manned by Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a gradual, predominantly American, then American with civilian technicians and some administrators. And then the build-up of the Canadian components as new radar stations came in, and then at a later date, American radar stations being taken over by the Canadians, and we didn't take over nearly as many as they wanted us to.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, of course, this became naturally between the three services a point of concern when they'd say, "Well, fine, take over." I don't know if stations amounting to 5,000 or 6,000 men, plus their support. And the tri-service ceiling was set. The Army didn't have enough people to ensure that it could carry out its naval obligations and the UN ones, which were called upon to do. And something had to give. Either they had to raise the establishment. And the raising of the establishment, obviously, is a very expensive thing. So within a given establishment, there was always this difficult point for the chiefs of staff to settle. Where did the manpower come from to do all this?
Yeah.
And it didn't matter if you had said, fine, we'll free the manpower sitting, but we will keep the budget. I can remember when I was there, they said the tri-service budget will be $1.5 billion, and it will not be any greater, and we all had our ideas of the share.
Mm.
But if you had said, fine, we'll raise it, the regular ceiling to 150,000 or 160,000,
yeah,
and you did, then you wouldn't have money for equipment. If you raise personnel, and you need tanks, and you need new aircraft, and you have to build radar stations, every time you take on a job, it's not only the personnel, but it's the hardware. And hardware is very expensive. Well, radar stations and planes and tanks are very expensive.
You have at this time, or not you, but I mean about 1957, 1958, according to some stuff I was reading in the House of Commons debates, one civilian for every two servicemen, I think. It's a 2-to-1 basis. Now,
it's a very high proportion of civilians, yes. We went over that in previous paper, and I think you saw some of my letters on it. The theory, and Mr. Fleming was the, I'm speaking now of the period 58-61. Mr. Fleming was the Minister of Finance. Kirk is our minister. And on the one hand, they were saying to the three services, convert more and more of your military positions, particularly headquarters, engineers, and all these rich people, drivers, to civilian. And on the other hand, the Treasury Board staff was saying you have to cut your civilian establishments.
In
our view, to be quite frank about it, we had said, and this is not a very strong letter, but it's the first sign that we carved out for him, that this seemed to us to be a game, a method of cutting the military establishment. And if they were going to cut it, well then, fine. Don't do it this way. Say what it's going to be cut to, and ask us what we can do, what commitment we must give up.
Yeah, it seemed to me, I remember now the argument, that they want service positions converted into civilian and then chop the civilian, that sort of thing.
Well, a very good example is civilian component rose very rapidly, both in numbers and in contracts, when we went over to Korea.
Yeah.
First went over. For example, when I came back from England to the QMG, I found that in a very large number of our stations and depots, Churchill, Petawawa, Wainwright, a number of these anyway, that the catering contracts were given, rather than having your Army Service Corps and your cooks and things,
yep.
They ran the kitchens, and we nearly had some riots because they were making a lot of money out of it. The expenses were very great. We did this because we had to take all the trained cooks, water washers, and send them to Korea, because you couldn't send a civilian contract. Well, our argument was that you could do it more cheaply for the soldiers, and if you kept on doing this, where would we have the cooks?